Siren FM.
Absolutely sensational. Whilst they've been doing the news, we've been eating cake. Well, it's the way of the sort of show in many ways, and it is Jessica's cake that's been put together there. I think actually, Jessica, if you've got a couple of pieces, you should actually provide them for our two news readers. That would be Tom and Martina, who obviously made their debut on the whole system there and did a very good job. We thought they did a very good job when we obviously were not eating cake, which is the way forward. Let them eat cake. Very important from that perspective. Okay, coming up very shortly, Larry Nemeczek will be hopefully joining us to share with us the latest scenarios, as indeed you alluded to in a little Deep Space Nine thing. We might test him in terms of that and see whether he's up for that.
See what he knows.
See what he does know from
everything,
that perspective.
Probably.
Well, that's why he is Dr. Trek, the official line as far as the whole thing is concerned. Shall we go for a Tessa Start jingle? Yeah, well, why not?
Congratulations, guys. Glinton has now officially been put on the broadcasting map with Tessa Snart taking midweek drive-at duties to a whole new level. Hannah Brown, historic Harwick heroine and hyperbolic midweek drive-at.
Are you sure it's not Harwich? Harwich heroine?
What did I say?
You said Harwick. The hyperbolic midweek drive-at was right. Also, I love the deep breath you took before Hannah Brown, like you're taking a big bite out of Hannah Brown. We're keeping all this in.
Hey, this is Larry Nemeczek, Dr. Trek, and you're listening to the Midweek Drive.
We can hear you, Larry. We can hear you, honestly. How are you, Larry Nemeczek? Good morning. In terms of Los Angeles time, are you keeping well?
We are. Thank you. Hope everyone's well there.
Excellent. I've just actually been tagging on the drive at. Good things about having that news thing is you can do a sort of photo shoot and hopefully get it all uploaded and signed as well. I would have actually tagged Natasha, but I can't tag Natasha. She's a very exclusive person, Paul Duck and so on. In the studio, we have Natasha Chambers, we have Jessica Ward and Larry. It's a historic period in time because it's Jessica's last show for quite some time, which is why she's brought in cake.
Uh-huh.
She's brought in cake with kiwi. I'm just going to
national New Zealand dish.
I'm going to taste the little cake at this sort of moment. So I'm on it. No, very, very, very good.
Oh, now it's official. Okay.
Officially melts in the mouth, and as Jessica will tell from a whole range of other factors, I don't know the news team. Are they actually? Do they think it's like a custard pie contest? You're supposed to eat it. I'll work our way through that process anyway. You had a question for Larry, I believe, Darren Scales.
Oh, we were just talking about the cake and the absence of mint frosting.
Yes.
And a certain Star Trek character would be most irritated if there wasn't mint frosting on there. Or prune juice, in fact.
Prune juice.
No.
Before you actually answer, Larry, let's see if the midweek drivettes can identify which character we're referring to. Hannah, any idea? Prune juice, mint frosting.
I've only ever seen the two Star Trek films, so I have no idea.
So a relative novice to the joyous
Star
world
Trek
of Trek.
Is, right. is my learning fandom curve. Downfall.
Right. Yeah. Tessa,
I'm
wrong.
Quite ignorant
no, it's not
going to
work.
I'm willing to learn, though.
It's okay. Jessica?
I'll wait. I'm exactly the same. No idea.
Well, the ball is in Natasha Chambers' court. I mean, we did Natasha Armstrong's court. Won't get the right name here.
I'd rather it was in hers, because I've got no idea.
It's like being back on that
Spock
show you used to on a morning with Darren, with Jared, etc. It is not Spock, but he is an alien. and he did have human parentage who adopted him, and he was secured after the Kitama massacre. It isn't Data.
That's the only other one I know.
Oh, dear. Oh, honour. It is, of course, Darren.
It is Worf. Son of Moog.
And Larry, you will attest to that. It is indeed the son of Moog. Worf.
Because, of course, mint frosting and prune juice are hallmarks of Klingon culture, so yes.
So true.
That's it. Bring on the blood wine.
And the gah. Yes. Gah. Best served live.
Best
served live.
Yeah,
we could go on and talk about Star Trek for such a long time, but then we've got a Star Wars producer coming up at about 4:15, so we best not do that. Different time. Larry, you've had a chance to look at some of Darren's movies from that point of view. I mean, Darren, you've always been a science fiction fan, and obviously now you're making material, etc. As you say, you've done a couple of Star Wars things. If you got the call to actually come across and direct Star Trek Discovery, would you be up for it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Star Trek has been a massive influence in sort of a lot of the science fiction stuff that I've done. In fact, the Dark Wave universe has a lot of connection with Star Trek in terms of it's set in the same universe as ours. Not so much 400 years in the future, but 100 years. But it very much focuses on technology. I wanted the universe to be realistic. And I've always looked at Star Trek as being the sort of pioneer of realistic sci-fi, for me anyway. The technical manual, reading the companion, all that kind of stuff. Certainly it's been a massive influence in my own science fiction journey.
Well, we were talking last week, of course, with Professor Carenza Lewis, which reminds me, actually, Hannah, did you get to the Science Festival?
Yes, I did. I went to go see her exhibit with the pottery, and it was very interesting. Yeah. Sorry, stumbling over
the cake has actually been laced with alcohol, so the fact of the matter is, by the time we get to 7:00, we'll probably be completely inebriated.
Not since the hall.
I've already spelt cream over the trousers. It's just
I expect no less.
Exactly. It's what we call celebrating when you're in New Zealand, Spain, and the Isle of Man. It's outrageous. You know, Bridget will be on the phone. Who knows what'll be happening? Tessa, did you go to this science festival?
I wanted to. Yeah. I said I would, and I missed it.
Natasha?
I was unfortunately in bed all day ill, so I'm very sorry to have disappointed you.
Well, not to worry, because in a couple of days' time, I'll hopefully be experiencing, sadly without Larry Nemechek, Destination Star Trek in Birmingham. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that. So, Larry, what should I sort of prepare for? I mean, I'm not going to make the full 3 days. I've talked about a few other things. I've already been told I should be speaking to a few CBS people who are actually there and so on. I think we've got Jadzia Dax, both incarnations will be there. Nicole DeBoer and Terry Farrell will actually be there. Lennon Nimoy's son, Adam, will be there. But the great news as far as Midway Drive is concerned is hopefully Saturday, October 29th, we'll be hieing off to Blackpool with Ryan Jones to actually see some of the legendary artwork that's just been launched in the whole Star Trek Leonard Nimoy sort of world. So the art of Star Trek and more. Anyway, key thing is, I still think it's a disgrace you aren't over here again, Larry, because the fact of the matter is, a Star Trek convention without Larry Nemechek, it's almost exactly.
I'm honored that you even deigned to venture there without me being there. So, good on you, Alex.
Oh,
it is a big world out there. I can't do it all. So.
I think we do have the editor of Star Trek Monthly there, as far as I believe. So, if I get a chance, I'll say, exactly.
Yeah.
What's happening?
He's waiting on something for me right now. Waiting on my caller.
You see, it's all coming together splendidly. Natasha, would you consider yourself a Star Trek fan, or is it a case of like the Beatles, you can't stand them? Sorry, I know it's a hell of a leak to give away, but still.
I'm more of Star Wars than Star Trek, I would say. But
you can have both, of course.
Yes, you can. I'm willing to be converted.
Hmm. And Hannah, is it more Doctor Who as opposed to Star Trek in terms
Who all the way.
All the way.
Oh, yeah. Doctor Who forever.
They have worked together, of course. You have had the 11th Doctor actually appear, I believe, in graphic narrative form, at least, in the bridge of the Star Trek Next Generation. Does that fall within your purview, Larry, obviously answering questions about the graphic narrative world of Star Trek?
Older. But there was a time when I had to keep the comics and the novels separate because there was so much television being produced that I couldn't let it pollute my or confuse my addled brain.
You can have the X-Men meeting Jean-Luc Picard in the novels scenario, and then you can actually have Planet of the Apes universe with Galen and company encountering James T. Kirk as well in Star Trek meets Planet of the Apes for IDW Productions. Anyway.
Right. You know, getting in line behind the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Always of importance. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, infinite diversity and infinite combinations. And proving that that is the theme of the programme, given that Jessica uttered the words, Dr. Strange, what's it all about? Jessica, Dr. Stephen Strange, former neurosurgeon, had an accident. His hands effectively sort of became, well, not damaged, but he couldn't. He had a nerve challenge. The only way he could actually seek redemption was by going to Tibet, meeting the Ancient One, in the movie actually played by Cate Blanchett, I believe. So it's an ancient, one female sort of take on the whole thing, where he learns the mystic arts. He becomes the master of the mystic arts, so phrases like, by the hoary hosts of Hogarth and by the crimson eye of Agamotto are regularly used. That's all you really need to know to appreciate the joy and delight that will be the Stephen Strange movie or the Doctor Strange movie.
So it's quite spiritual in a sort of way, isn't
it? It's spiritual, it's metaphysical, we haven't had Doctor Strange meeting Star Trek as yet, but I mean, Larry, Doctor Strange, does it float your boat from a sort of graphic narrative perspective?
I'm not a huge fan, but I'm always curious to see how they make these crossovers work. So, well, I've been, the last few years it's been easier to pay attention to the comics go by, so this is especially one that I think I'll be interested in.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Marvel Universe has so far not dropped the ball as yet, and I think it's the same sort of character as Ant-Man in many ways. But Stephen Strange, also one of the founding fathers of the Defenders, and generally an all-around sort of mystical person. His major enemy is, of course, the dread Dormammu, and, of course, Mordo the Mystic. So, again, and the movie, of course, is being played by Benedict Cumberbatch, so you've got, you know, Khan playing Sherlock, playing Stephen Strange. That's got to work, hasn't it, Darren?
Oh, it's a perfect combination. I'm sure he'd be very different in all of those roles.
You saying he's an actor? You saying he translates in all sorts of ways? Outrageous.
I thought he was actually quite good as Khan. It was a little bit predictable. I enjoy the rebranding, the rebooting of Star Trek. I'm a Next Gen fan. That's my main area. But I actually thought, you know, he did a pretty good job as Khan. Not as good as the original, I would say. But even so, still good fun.
Yeah, I mean, I think the movie is being reappraised slightly because initially it was a case of, please, I can't stand this, what have you done? But now seen as sort of like a thing that in what, as Larry will correctly say, is a universe in which we refer to as the Kelvin timeline.
Absolutely, yeah. In fact, they were talking about redoing Next Gen as a Kelvin timeline, or the posturing the question, at least, what if, you know, now it's all changed? Actually looking to yesterday's Enterprise as an example of that time shift.
So, Larry, if we took Tasha Yar and put her into yet another timeline, would it just create all sorts of confusion? Will we see Jean-Luc Picard not actually sort of get stabbed by the Nausicaan? What would happen? Would it be a tapestry unravelled? Your thoughts, please, Dr. Trek.
You're asking me. Here's my thing. I don't know why everyone is so in love with rebooting. I mean, I want to keep going to where no one has gone before. I would rather keep exploring pockets of the timeline and the canon that no one has seen yet, that haven't been touched. So the whole thing of going back and revisiting what's out there, to me, is I'm sure it might be great stories and all that, but I'd just rather go see new eras.
Which is fair enough, but
I hope the reboot era has kind of passed.
Well, if we return to the political aspect, and let's face it, sometimes life is political, I noticed that on LarryNemecek.com we have Trek against Trump. So, I think you need to share with the youth of today what exactly Trek against Trump actually is. Are we saying that, you know, this could be a whole new field? I mean, you know, maybe in the words of William Shatner, you should just let them suffer. Anyway, carry on.
Yeah. No, this was this is an interesting, from your perspective over there, you've had a lot of interesting once-in-a-lifetime political events going down.
Yeah, we've even had Nigel Farage's old party effectively have to deal with a leader that's kind of gone and got Nigel Farage back. I wonder if we'd be able to accept Donald Trump's representation now. It's just amazing. By the way, Larry, I have to point out for yourself and the listener with the all-seeing eye, and we mean you, Dr. Strange, we're currently saying farewell, our Wiedersehen, goodbye to, not Jessica Ward, she's in for the duration, but to Hannah Brown and Tessa Snart. They'll be back for the morning edition. Don't worry. They're just off to do various other things. It's nothing you said, Larry. Don't worry. It's okay. It's sort of...
Oh, okay.
And it means
that...
Yeah, exactly. Bye-bye. It's heartrending. It's, you know, really, we should reinstate the video cameras. It's marvellous. Where were we? Oh, yes. Trek against Trump. Does that appeal to you yourself?
No,
yes. Go, Larry.
You know, I was just going to say that. So that was just a couple of weeks ago, barely 10 days ago. Several of the, a few of the cast, two or three of the actors, people had done some things on their own because they felt like, I mean, just to be political for a second, they had felt like the campaign was not in the ideals of Star Trek, even more so than the normal realm, which is back and forth partisanship. And people were disturbed enough by Donald Trump's campaign, a few, that they thought that just a simple statement, just three paragraphs on a page, no big deal, just would satisfy their consciences. And it hasn't turned into a huge firestorm, but it's picked up a lot of media attention. There's over 140, not just actors, but writers, directors, crew people, people who worked on ancillary things like the books and comics, people that wanted to sign on, basically saying that Donald Trump is not in line, it's not how we get to a Star Trek future because of the tolerance and respect and diversity, respect for science, and that they just felt like just saying that. And they would urge, and not to even urge a third-party vote because the goal is not to have him be president, and voting for our Libertarian or our Green Party would not get there, would take away votes. So that's it. It was very unprecedented.
For a moment, I thought...
lots of people, but yeah.
Well, you've got Catherine Janeway there, so, you know, clearly... Oh, no, it's Kate Mulgrew. It's got to be the winner from that perspective. Jessica, any thoughts on this?
I think it's a very original idea, Trek against Trump. But, yeah, the whole political thing that's going over there in America is very interesting. And
spoken as a true New Zealander with dual nationality, British citizenship,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah. So we'll just wait and see what happens and just... hope for the best, eh?
Always important.
It's interesting what's happening in terms of this recent election and the whole sci-fi world, because Marvel, some of the Marvel actors I've noticed have also been producing a video kind of pro-Hillary. Well, not pro-Hillary as so much as anti-Trump. And it's just really interesting how much of like the sci-fi world is kind of getting involved in this. It's quite bizarre. Politics and sci-fi.
Creating our own reality. Yep. Sounds as though it could be a topic.
One with some of the sci-fi actors from the film world, from the Marvel and DC, some of the superhero people, the video that's gone viral, and even prompted an anti-response ad from the other side.
Darren, as a filmmaker, I mean, any sort of political edge? Because I mean, I think it's fair to say that when you look at The Drift, you look at the, for a moment, I was just the sequel, which
Edge
is
of the Storm.
Edge of the Storm,
yeah.
You're it's kind of politically neutral, really. There's clearly this whole notion of
the issue with Edge of the Storm is that you have the Ministry, who are the bad guys, the omnipresent, evil but elected, which, you know, that's what Trump would be, you know, evil and elected. I think it's interesting how it's always difficult for celebrities and all that to make a political statement, because ultimately we watch Star Trek for entertainment, inspiration and motivation. And, you know, when you start crossing the line between what is fiction and what we aspire to what is the reality, but at the same time you look at the story context of Star Trek, especially about, you know, equality, diversity, respect, all the things that, you know, that we are attracted to. Yeah, more people will probably watch Star Trek than will go and vote. So perhaps it is appropriate that, you know, celebrities involved in sci-fi, people who actually enjoy that storyline, that story arc, well, this is real, boys and girls. So get out there and vote.
It's almost paraphrasing William Shatner's Get a Life, really, though. Hopefully Larry's now got the right hand of the phone, because for a moment I thought we was being lost in some sort of Tholian web, really. But, you know, all being well. Any final closing thoughts, Larry, that you've got? Either advice for me as I attempt my first destination Star Trek. Oh, that's very exciting. On Saturday. I could be at an open day at the University of Lincoln, but tough call, really. Still, obviously, if you are listening to this, you're thinking of coming to the University of Lincoln for an open day, particularly to study public relations or journalism, please feel free to do so. You know, English as well, from that point of view, it's there. And remember, Destination Star Trek goes over 3 days, so we'll work through that. So, any final thoughts from your good self, Larry Nemechek?
Well, Alex, as you venture to destination, just take lots of water and snacks. You know, you're stranded in line somewhere.
Well, I don't do queues. I'm not one for queues, really. I think I might sort of skip the queues.
They call them lines, Alex. Lines.
I would hope your press pass would say that. No, and just, you know, just plan well, because it'll be an overwhelm, and in a good way. So enjoy yourself, and I hope you survived it talk to you on the other side.
Well, that's the idea, because clearly, you know, the key, and Jessica will ask you those last two questions, but obviously we need to follow through with that whole thing, because I think it's next week we have Nurse Ogawa, Patty Yasutake, is joining us on the production. There's mm-hmm. a next generation little tribute for you. She might end up in your next movie, Darren. Yeah. Who knows?
And a lovely person.
Well, we'd like to hear that's positive. Anyway, Jessica, last two questions for yourself, please.
All righty then. Have you enjoyed your telephonic link with us today?
As always, yes, indeed.
Fab. And will we be hearing from you soon?
I hope so. You know, you can't keep me away. Unless, of course, you do.
Larry, please, believe me, if you were going to be cut adrift from the good ship Midweek Drive, you'd know about it. You know, we'd send some of the boys around.
It would have been long ago.
We'd have some concrete galoshes. You'd be wearing cement overshoes. You'd be getting all sorts. Yeah, and we'd be playing Fizbin. Absolutely frank, if you wanted to add a touch of class to the Midweek Drive, you clearly would wish to actually have somebody who had experience with David Lean and also, amongst other things, was responsible for green lighting the movie that you may have heard of, Natasha, 1977 Star Wars, I believe it was called. And there's a fantastic tale about the focus groups and their input to that. We, of course, are delighted beyond measure to be able to welcome to the production for his debut on the Midweek Drive, producer, writer, general all-round bon viveur, it's the delightful and really wonderful Peter Beale. How are you, Peter?
Well, I'm very well after that extraordinary introduction.
I thought it was only...
By the reality.
Well, no, I thought after Charlie Ross introduced you, obviously, at the Starburst International Film Festival, I needed to at least raise the bar a bit more, so wonderful that you're actually joining us. We have three fine folk in the studio, all of whom are, I think, keen Peter Beale fans in all sorts of ways. We have Darren Scales, filmmaker, who actually, Darren, you have made a couple of Star Wars light movies, shall we say.
Yeah, a couple of fan films, the first one being The Empire Strikes Backyard. And the second being The Emperor's New Clones. They've done all right for themselves.
The Empire Strikes Backyard and The Emperor's New...
The Emperor's New Clones.
Might have passed the Peter Beale test. It may not have. We've got Natasha, of course, Natasha Armstrong, a big Star Wars fan, I believe.
Yes, in my household, Star Wars is very, very popular.
And Jessica, who's familiar with the franchise.
Yes, I love it. And my brother and I often just watch it on repeat sometimes.
And yet, Peter, it very nearly didn't get made. And before we start talking about your own career history and so on, I'd love that story that you shared with us about focus groups and how Star and Wars just didn't sit together. Would you like to just share that with us now?
Yes. Well, after we'd made it, and while the distribution team at Fox were preparing to release it, they were having difficulty getting bookings in cinemas, and they tested the name Star Wars with the public. And you've got to remember the time it was. There was a lot of memory of Vietnam and Korea War, and they were told that the public were fed up with war films. They didn't want any more of them. And, of course, Stars, space, there really hadn't been a successful space film except 2001, which was considered intellectual, and so it was considered to be a type of a B-movie, and they got a very, very negative response to the name and were talking about changing it. Are you there?
Yes, we haven't left you. I think it's still the shock of that. Darren, any thoughts or questions from yourself?
Well, yeah, it's so interesting. The name of a film can make or break. And you don't really know, I suppose, until you get out there and see what happens. And, of course, that's a very big risk when you've just spent a lot of money on a film. And if you get it wrong, then, yeah, you're kind of screwed. So, I mean, even with my own films, my original movies, the name has changed several times without the benefit of massive focus groups. But the Initially it was called Starlight, and that was too Disney, and then we've now changed to Dark Wave, and then of course Dark Matter came out and Dark everything else, so Dark seems to be the new thing. So it's like, what do you do? So a big risk.
As T.S. Eliot once said, the naming of names.
In the entertainment business, though, it is very difficult to ask people what they're going to want to do next. And so, really, this is the creative role. This is the director, the producer's role, is really to come up with that and stick with it and make it happen. And I'm not sure that names are as important. There's one film that I think that was the first Planet of the Apes, I don't think had as big as an audience as it would have had if it had another name, because that was considered at the time to be B-movie name. But most names, I don't think, are as important as the content of the film.
Looking at some of your own names, Peter, are Alien, The Omen, The Rocky Horror Picture Show, The Other Side of Midnight, Sky Riders, we've already mentioned A Touch of Class, The Jazz Singer with Neil Diamond, the remake, presumably. I mean, I suspect you weren't around with respect to the original Al Jolson piece. Although, that's what I thought.
I wasn't, no.
No. But, you know, some wonderful sort of cinematic history of the 70s and 80s from that perspective. Very good. Natasha, thoughts for yourself?
Yeah, no, it's interesting you were saying how you didn't think the name compared to the content was as important, because I just can't imagine Star Wars being called anything else. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's it's just such a huge brand, the way that it's endured over the decades. I think it's amazing that it's had such an impact coming out. I mean, I remember stories that my dad told me. He used to show films. He used to, in the cinemas when he was younger, that was his job. And he can remember...
He was a projectionist.
And he can remember standing there watching this film with his mouth just hanging open. He actually forgot to change the slide because, you know, he was that engrossed in what was happening on the screen.
I mean, that must be really rewarding, Peter, from your own perspective as a producer, given the challenges that you had and some of the tales that you shared about how George Lucas, wonderful talent, but frankly painfully shy, and of course the tremendous drawings of the late, great Ralph McQuarrie, really. The sort of the ingredients were all there.
Yes, but I must correct you, though. I wasn't producer. I was executive in charge of production. And on a lot of the films you've listed, I was either executive production, and some of them I was an assistant director on. Mm. So I don't want to exaggerate my role.
Oh, you're part of cinematic history. That's the important thing, as our Starburst correspondent Ed Fortune actually said. Jessica, any questions or thoughts from yourself?
I just think it's amazing that you were part of something so big, and it has, like Natasha said, it's affected so many people, and it was like, it was just so big for its time in terms of cinematography and just the way it was filmed and all these latest inventions in that field.
To say that every studio in Hollywood had turned it down as being unmakeable. And Fox at the time was the weak studio, and so we were offered it last. And my boss, Alan Ladd Jr., liked the script and didn't know if it could be made, and it was sent to me to find out if it could be made. And, of course, England, the British Isles, has wonderful technicians and skills, and I was able to bring together a team to interpret Ralph McQuarrie's beautiful artwork and George's vision, and that team were the people that made it happen at a price that was very economical, when all the Hollywood experts said it was impossible. So we can take credit for that, and I think it's fair to say that we set the style for it.
I love the line about price. It brings us around to budget, of course. And Darren, I'm going to come to your good self, because one of the things that critics from the London Sci-Fi Film Festival and Starburst magazine have been astounded at is the labour of love that you put together in your first feature. Would you like to just share your tale with Peter and maybe get some input in terms of that?
Well, yeah. I mean, I've watched many of the documentaries on the making of Star Wars, A New Hope in particular, in 1976 and obviously 77, and how inspirational it was, and looking at how they did things. And then to make my own science fiction films and to discover that many of the things that we do at a low budget level is not too dissimilar to what they do at the big budget level. You know, there are obviously differences, cameras and actors and all that kind of thing. But we made The Drift, a science fiction movie set in space. It's actually filmed in a very large room with corridors, because in every space movie you have to have corridors and blast doors. Even the Death Star had corridors. So, you know, we had to change them all around and make it work. You know, pipes made out of carpet roll tubes, all that kind of thing. So the whole budget was £5,000, and we're just about to hit 500,000 views. So, yeah, lots of inspiration from, you know, how clever they were making, you know, the Star Wars movies in particular.
Inspiring the 21st century filmmaker, Peter. Can't be bad.
Yes. Well, you just go back to the name. The original name of the first script was The Adventures of Luke Skywalker, and it was changed to Star Wars afterwards.
Well, yeah. The original, you know, the trilogy centres around, obviously, Luke and his father. And again, when I was watching it, when I was very young, when it first came out, and seeing it with my father and all the rest of it, and then...
Because obviously, Darren, yourself and myself, we were kind of the first... We were there. We were around when it was there.
I was five. I was very young when Star Wars came out.
Exactly. Well, and so on. But in the case of, obviously, Natasha...
Well, I did a twinkle in our father's eye.
Exactly. It certainly has echoed that. I mean, Peter, is this due to the quality of the storytelling? Is it that, in a sense, Hero of a Thousand Faces that Joseph Campbell puts together? Is it the notion that it's the Force, it's the magic of the Force working? I mean, any theories, or is it a case of if you knew the theory, you could bottle it and set up all sorts of things?
I think that's... Well, your last statement is true. It's obviously a combination of things. It was visually startling. It was visually new. Brilliant art direction, brilliant designer, starting with Ralph McCrory. Great photography. And then you had wonderful actors and the anchor of Alec Guinness, creating incredible credibility. And you had Harrison Ford, who was a minor character originally and wasn't even in the original poster. And he, as an actor, brought an extra dimension. And you wrap all that and the adventure into the whole spiritual force aspect. And I think that it is the subconscious of the spiritual force that really finds it and makes it a difference. And in fact, I gave a lecture on that at Starburst about what the force is, if it's real, and if it's real, how we can connect to it. And of course, it is real. And Star Wars wasn't the first people to think about the force. Polynesian societies have had it. The American Indians, the Apaches, the Navajo had it. And so it's been around a long time, and Star Wars was the first film to really bring it forward, although it's touched slightly in Star Trek.
Indeed, sort of the universal harmony, which you could argue is one of the reasons we can connect across the Atlantic with your good self, Peter. It's amazing.
Yes, I'm... from sunny California, Hollywood.
Well, it's always
very jealous. Well,
this is the California Los Angeles hour. We have Larry Nemechek, who started off obviously with Star Trek, Peter obviously with us now, and Phil Leonis wraps up the Los Angeles scenario. As I said, when the university wants to put together a Star Wars day, I'll mention it to Early Sample, you can contact Peter, but you need to get him over from California again. That's the key thing. It's an important thing to join us in Lincoln. Peter, the other sort of aspect, of course, is Alien, which is another wonderful movie, and certainly fired off, although he'd done lots of wonderful commercial directors before then, but really Scott into a whole new field. Any sort of, did you feel Alien when that sort of script passed across your desk? Did you think, actually, yeah, we like to have things exploding out of chests and so on. This is good.
I thought that the Alien script was good, but the first script lacked something, and Walter Hill, with Ridley. Ridley's one of the most exciting directors to work with, and a privilege to work with him. He wanted something, and he made it very simple. He said, look, this is a story about an old tramp steamer in the Indian Ocean that's broken down, and the monsters come on board, and the crew aren't the crew that can get on the Cunard liners. They're the ones that quite missed it. You've got these eccentric, sort of rough Scottish engineers, etc., and the ship is rusting. And with that kind of symbolism, Walter Hill was able to take the script, and he's not credited for it, but he brought the dialogue, an energy and a simplicity to it. And the art direction, if you look at it, all goes back to that. Ridley would say, well, what would it be like in the hold of the ship? dripping water and chains to lift the cargo up. And so that made it real, and that was really wonderful. And of course, you can't ignore Sigourney Weaver and the extraordinary performance she gave.
Darren.
Yeah, I mean, again, the Alien, especially the first one for me, was also a massive influence, particularly with The Drift, which is a movie. So it's about a derelict spaceship. A salvage crew goes to a spaceship to pick up computer data and stuff. That's the valuable booty at the time.
I'm going to play devil's advocate here. I'm going to suggest, actually, if Peter would be kind of... Peter, if I sent you the link to Darren's movie, would you be able to have a quick look at it? Not now,
yeah,
obviously.
About right now.
No. I realise time is an illusion in all sorts of ways. But no, I mean, would you be happy with that, Darren?
Yeah, certainly check out the trailer or something. It's very alien.
I shall do that in the next day or so. We'll do the connections on that sort of basis.
Yeah,
wonderful. That's sort of news from there.
I'd be very honoured to look at it. Yeah.
Too kind. You haven't seen it yet. It's not quite the budget.
Heartily covered too. Jessica, any other sort of thoughts that you have in terms of... I mean, we haven't even had a chance to speak about his work with David Lean and Lawrence of Arabia and Dr. Zhivago and heaps of other things. Well,
I was privileged to work with David Lean on two of his great movies, and he was my mentor when I was a young man. He was very generous and became an official mentor to me, and was extraordinary. And I think I worked on his two best films. And he was a detailist, a visualist, and understood the psychology of actors better than anyone. I think Ridley Scott is by far the most visual director I've worked with and enjoyed, and others have different strengths. I've been very privileged to work with so many of them. But David Lean and Ridley are up there.
Genuinely, I mean, there's a whole scenario there. We talk about, obviously, say, a touch of class from that point of view. Natasha, any final thoughts from yourself?
I just thought it was really interesting how you were talking about, you know, getting the realism in the ship and, you know, all the sounds and then being in the hold and what's it like. Because that must be quite difficult when you're dealing with a topic, you know, so out there as sci-fi. How do you make it real for the audience? How do you make them believe?
Well, that was Ridley, because Ridley... draw storyboards in black and white, and when you look at them, you first can understand. But he draws what you're going to get, and his art departments eventually get it and make it happen, and he's quite remarkable. You mentioned touch of class. At the time, films made in England weren't transferring easily over to America, and I come to the conclusion that we were spending too much time showing what I would call Enid Blyton policemen and red buses and
Are you suggesting that Hammer's On the Buses TV sequence wasn't a classic of British cinema, Peter? Sorry, I'm only kidding.
So what we tried to do was to show in Touch of Class a modern London, even within the Nash terraces and everything. Mm. And I think we successfully did that, and the film translated around the world visually. It took it out of colonial England and into another level, and I think that we were very successful at that, but obviously had two wonderful actors and a very funny director.
Well, certainly when you've got Glenda Jackson and George Segal and Melvin Frank on the team, this romantic comedy about a pair of clandestine lovers in a London-Spain tryst it won an Oscar. That's right. It won an Academy Award, you know, and it's just wonderful stuff from that point of view. So great material from that perspective. Actually, Peter, there is one little story I'd love you to share, and it goes back to the Star Wars, and it was the way in which you managed to work in the permits for Harrison Ford, Carrie Fisher, and Mark Hamill. Three actors inevitably associated with Star Wars, but there was a chance that Equity might have actually said, you can't have those guys in there. What was the strategy?
Well, Equity, quite rightly, the British Actors' Equity, the Actors' Union in England, their job is to protect the English actors and to get them a chance to work. And, of course, a lot of films wanted to bring foreign actors in, quite rightly, because they helped in the box office. So if you had a star like we had on Omen of Gregory Peck, they argued fervently saying, well, there's great English actors could do it, but eventually I could get them in. I could get a work permit. You had to go to the Home Office to get a work permit. But on Star Wars, George wanted three unknown actors, Harrison Ford, Carrie Fisher, and Mark Hamill. And so there was no way in the ordinary course of events that Equity would agree. Eventually, it was a Home Office decision. So what we had to do was to build up the English cast, and we obviously had Alec Guinness and Peter Cushing, but we built up, if you like, in the importance, the roles of Darth Vader and C-3PO and R2-D2 and all the other cast. And when we came to ask the permit, Harrison, Ford, etc., were at the bottom of the list as minor, and we were able to show that we were bringing a lot of money into the country, a lot of employment, and the Home Office were very helpful in persuading Equity that they should give us permits. And we got permits, but it wasn't straightforward.
Well, there you see, just every tale, a wonderful. In fact, we could almost make a movie about the making of the movie of Star Wars. Got me sort of lined from that point of view. Peter, it's been a genuine delight touching base with your good self. I feel as though we've just sort of had a slice of British and American cinematic history and delight provided for our listener, which is brilliant stuff there. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on this, your Midweek Drive debut?
Yes, thank you.
Good.
I've enjoyed it.
So the next critical question is, will you be kind enough to join us again in the not-too-distant future and keep us appraised as another one of our official Californian correspondents about life over in L.A. and beyond?
Well, it's nice to have a new title.
Official California correspondent. And a round of applause for Peter Beale, please. Yay! And as we've heard...
Thank you, all of you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
So let's just burst in with some breaking news, Darren Scales. Share this breaking news with our listener, please.
Well, just to say that my latest movie, Dark Wave, Edge of the Storm, has been nominated on the shortlist for the Parallax Film Festival 2016.
And the Parallax Film Festival takes place where and obviously?
Well, Los Angeles, obviously.
You never know.
I think it does, I'm guessing. We've mentioned the film now in probably about 10 festivals.
So actually, Peter Beale and some of our other Los Angeles correspondents could technically actually attend.
Well, they could go to the Raw Science Film Festival, which has also been shortlisted for, and that is certainly in Los Angeles.
There are so many things that our Chilpack Hollywood correspondents could actually open up for. I haven't even opened up his channel as yet because, you know, we just had to sort of break into that before, of course, we have another outing. Some might say actually one of the final outings for this particular ident, which was specially written, constructed, and indeed developed by ace actress. That would be Lily Holloman.
Now, back from Madrid, and bringing the best of New Zealand and the Isle of Man to the program, it's Jessica Ward.
If I'd known it was just a short-term stay before you went off to actually... I mean, what would Phil Lynn say about that? He sweated blood over these sort of craft jingles and so on.
You know what we're going to do? You know what we'll do with that jingle, Alex? Is we'll just substitute in, like, my voice saying someone else's name right over the Jessica Ward part. So you'll hear Lily do the fanfare, and then it's Alex Lepcher. You know, that'll be what we'll do.
So there you go. Welcome to the show once again, Phil. We've got a little bit more time this week, thankfully, before we actually head up for a live commentary on soccer, to use the vernacular there, game between Bishop Crosthest and the University of Lincoln. Have you managed to catch any of the program today, or is it a case
you
of...
You do realize that I wasn't on last week's show, so when you say I have a little more time this week... I've already had it.
I thought you'd spot that. I know. Actually, Natasha, what I didn't reveal to Hannah and Tessa was that Philip was waiting by his telephone and it didn't ring and it was ringing out. Well, you were there. You witnessed the fact we were trying. And
we did try.
But this
honestly.
Week I kept the cell phone nearby, too, in case it was a problem this week. I kept the mobile nearby. I'd gotten, I don't know, overly confident in the landline situation, so, which is new technology, these landlines. By the way, you just had Darren, if you play it back on your own time, I'm sure I'll be correct in having heard this, the way that I'm repeating it, but you told Darren to break the news to our listener, singular.
Yeah. Well, you know, we'd like to feel we are conquering the world one listener at a time, you know.
Yeah. It's the way that Dean and I have always tried to shame people into listening to our podcast one person at a time. Which, by the way, thank you for bringing up my podcast. I mentioned a few weeks back, after we had done our show about the top ten horror films of all time. So I guess this was a little more than a month ago, right? And, of course, Alien, which you were just discussing with Mr. Beale, figured prominently on that list. But I mentioned to you that a magazine was turning our show into an article because that's what we need. We need more podcasts turned into print material.
And the future.
Indeed, that magazine has hit the stands. So everybody should look for a magazine by Game Traders called Live. I assume it's Live. I guess it could be Live. Really, but it's LIVE, and there's a big article, and I think it's a center spread, and it's the headline is "Our Friends in Podcasting Choose Their Top Horror Films." So that's kind of exciting. It's fun,
exactly.
Seeing my words translated into printed.
And I haven't sent a link to your movie, of course, to Darren either. Whereas obviously the reverse is the case. And have you done your homework, Phil Leonis?
What? You mean, I watched a movie that Darren had done.
Yes, yes.
Did you send me another link?
I did earlier this week, actually. His sequel, actually, which was there.
No. Things got to get sent out to me a little bit. Look, I'm... You know where I'm at in catching up on my stuff? 1950.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm in... Because of the success, and it is nice how everything I heard on the show dovetails neatly into things I need to promote... I have been preparing because the reaction to our top 10 horror films, of course, was so positive, and because we're in year 10 of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, we decided to do 10 top 10 shows during this year, and so we're about to record this weekend. I don't know when it'll drop, but we're about to record top 10 westerns of all time. So right now I'm watching 1950's The Gunfighter, directed by Henry King, his first of six collaborations with Gregory Peck. Ooh, boy, this is a good movie. But so anyway, I'm catching up on 1950 cinema. Nice. So I don't want to say, look, it's not going to take 66 years for me to catch up with Darren's 2016 opus, but it certainly might take me 16 days. Let's put it that way.
So happy with that, Darren?
Oh yeah, yeah. and any thoughts, and it would be well received. Certainly, take your time.
Yeah.
I think the title needs to change. No, see, that was a callback. That was fun because we know titles don't matter. You know, in fact, In fact, I always thought that this was a really funny kind of, I don't know, winking acknowledgement that George Lucas had to the Führer over not only the title for Star Wars, and I think that that's one of the things that has motivated Lucas throughout the years to constantly change the titles of his movies when he re-releases them. I mean, what is it? Is it Star Wars? Is it Episode 4? Is it A New Hope? What the hell is the name of the movie anymore? And Raiders of the Lost Ark was the same thing. You know, there was so much furor over what the title of that was. It now no longer even is Raiders of the Lost Ark. The official title now is Indiana Jones and Raiders of the Lost Ark. But I thought in the second Indiana Jones movie, it was such a wonderful winking acknowledgement that Lucas had about how sick to death he was over arguments over how important the titles are, that in the advertising for the second Indiana Jones movie, all the ads failed to have the name of the movie. They simply had the words, If Adventure Had a Name. And then some of them said, if Adventure Had a Name, it would be Indiana Jones. So they don't even use the title of the movie to advertise the movie. And then in the movie itself, it is, in Temple of Doom, it is the only movie in motion picture history where you literally can't read the title of the movie because Kate Capshaw is standing in front of the title. So it was just this wonderful thing that Lucas said, I'm so done with people arguing over the importance of titles that we're going to render a title meaningless in this film. And I think that's funny.
And strangely enough, actually, Phil, you've alluded there in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom to one of the classic lectures I provide for the film and television studies students, where I actually do an analysis of the first 5 or 10 minutes until indeed they leap out of Club Obi-Wan into the whole routine, short round, driving the cab as well. And you've got Busby Barkley musicals, you've got everything in there. It's anything goes, quite literally.
I don't want to get. There was too much good stuff on the show, so I don't want to get off into a huge Indiana Jones, rabbit hole.
I've got to eat the remains of Jessica's cake that she's provided for us, which I've been savoring the whole thing.
So, yeah. It's an underrated film. I've always believed Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom is an underrated film. I think it was very bold that they went in such a tonally different direction from the first one. I thought it was a very courageous movie, and it has always bothered me that when Steven Spielberg makes Indiana Jones 3, he says he's doing it to apologize for the second one, and so we can only assume that that's the reason he made the fourth one, was to apologize for the third one, and now that they're making a fifth one, well, we absolutely know he's apologizing for the fourth one. So anyway, when do the apologies end?
Natasha, you're almost having a fit. Please respond. I mean, I can.
I love the third one. The third one is the best one. I'm not gonna lie. I love it so much.
Let's go. Hold on. You loved it.
Yes.
You loved it. Period. That doesn't make it the best one. How does that make it the best one? Because you loved it.
Bear in mind, Phil, we've got to produce a jingle for Natasha Armstrong in the next few weeks. So who knows what's gonna happen?
Anyway. So it was really interesting that you. Spielberg said that he made that one, that his creative inspiration behind it was that he had always wanted to direct a James Bond movie. So that was how he tried to direct the third one. And, of course, it has the real James Bond in it, Sean Connery. The weird thing about it, though, is that he directs what really felt like a Roger Moore James Bond film, and I don't mean that as a compliment. So... What's fascinating about the Star Trek, everything that, you know, what you were talking about with Larry Nemesek, I was thinking about, and I can't wait for this, and I don't know what it would be, but, you know, I've been studying these Westerns, and as you know, Alex, when Star Trek was pitched...
Wagon Train to the Stars.
Wagon Train to the Stars, like Mr. Beale was referring to, it's so hard to get people to conceptualize what's next, what's going to be the next thing. Instead, you always have to pitch what it is like that has come before. And artists, to a degree, can't put it in terms like that because they are motivated by doing something new with something. But that was it. That was how Star Trek was pitched, was Wagon Train to the Stars. And here we are 50 years later, and let's face it, more people know what Star Trek is than what Wagon Train was. So what I'm curious about out is who's using Star Trek to pitch their thing that will be next.
Would that be you, Darren? Almost.
Maybe.
I've pitched Darkwave. I've described it as Knight Rider in space. Which is
Knight Rider, David Hasselhoff.
Fascinating. And then the response. Let me just. The response is, what's Knight Rider?
one man can make a difference. Yeah. You've got William Daniels as the voice of Kit. It's what's that? I mean, even Jessica, you must have heard of Knight Rider.
Oh, I've watched it before. Yes.
There we are. You see, before Baywatch, of course. BB, before Baywatch. another David Hasselhoff.
Battle of Baywatch.
Exactly. Right, okay, yeah. In fact, anyway, that's it. That's the movie we should actually go for, the making of the making of Star Wars. Think of it as a cross between Knight Rider and Baywatch.
Yeah. It could be scary. All in slow motion, of course.
Yep. I could actually resuscitate my attempt from the Autumn Flower Show, High Catch Your Pumpkins, as a possible working title as well. Just to catch all of the sort of farcical modes in there. Carry on, Phil. You're providing us with notes for the show.
Oh, I was just curious. When do we go on location to do a live show from your listener's place?
Well, I think we'll start with
that one listener.
Yeah, I'm figuring basically the last Saturday in October we move over to Blackpool. We do it from the bridge of the Starship Enterprise. It will happen.
Isn't it, instead of a Halloween themed show? Now, I know Halloween hasn't quite taken root there. I would say that from the bridge of the Nostromo would be a more appropriate,
Yeah, I see the alien connection, but unfortunately we don't have an identical replica of the Nostromo available, whereas in Blackpool they actually do, which we will...
You have weeks, and you have no shortage of able-bodied students at your disposal.
Just with lolly sticks and glue and a load of duct tape.
Now, I know, and Darren will attest to the quality of some of our fine makers and producers in terms of stuff from that point of view. But ultimately, I do feel that, as our screen for the Facebook there, doing a show from that particular location in Blackpool has got to be a key sort of aspect. Yeah?
Yeah, that's exactly.
Yeah. Anyway, time is a ticking, and obviously we still have the excitement of the football match that's taking place after 7 o'clock, and it is only now a little under 7 minutes before Jessica says farewell for the last time. I mean, I was so tempted to actually get her official speech written and the sort of the farewell thing. In fact, it was all set to actually go something which was pretty much going like this, really, in all sort of consideration.
Oh no, what have you done?
No, it's just...
So, Jessica, you've graduated? What, I don't...
I know. Yeah. She's leaving us.
No, yeah.
I got a Facebook message last night, ditched by Facebook, you know. The cake has helped, I must admit.
I did try and go find him, but he's a very busy man, unfortunately, isn't he?
I need more about this story. This is a very, very confusing, mysterious story. Yeah. I mean, where is Jessica really going? Mm. I mean, is she going to solve sexy religious crimes on the continent? I mean, I don't understand. What's the real story here? This seems very suspicious to me.
Well, I've been accepted into the rowing team here at the university, and I'm wanting to, because it's going to take up a lot of my time, and I've also got to catch up with some of my second year subjects, as I missed out when I was in Madrid. So I need to focus on my studies, but I thought I'd try something different also.
And a bit like the regeneration scene in Doctor Who, she's regenerating into Natasha Armstrong, which is fine. But
will you still be there, or you're going somewhere else?
No, I'll still be in Lincoln. So I'll definitely be here. I'm not like going off into space or anything.
You see, what might well happen is you get something that happens a bit like this.
What happened to Katie Grimason?
She graduated.
Oh, good for her.
And that's it. You know, they're there.
So Jessica's going undercover. I mean, this is like a 21 Jump Street kind of a thing. I mean, you train them, Alex, and then they go back into the student population and say, no, I'm not working for Siren FM at all. No, of course not. No, I'm not.
Okay.
But they're secretly reporting
on
everything that's going on.
Darren, you look as though you kind of... You've seen the light.
I'm just trying to see how I can make a movie out of all of this.
Gotta happen. And will indeed. Anyway, it is time for you, Jessica. I know he's in tears. Would you like to ask
no,
this?
So emotional. No,
well, I knew it was going to affect Phil in the same way as when Dean left for Australia. At least they managed to keep together by tapping the table and occasionally sort of Skype.
I can't. Changes. I'm done. Too many changes. I can't. We need to make the midweek drive great again.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, I mean, all of this.
Now back from Madrid and bringing the best of New Zealand and the Isle of Man to the programme. It's Jessica Ward.
But
that, didn't sound like Lily at all. That one.
Quite masculine, really.
That Lily Holloman.
Absolutely. Jessica, last two questions for Phil Leonis, please. Possibly forever from your own perspective.
Oh, don't say that. I'm sure I'll be back. Phil, have you had a reasonably wonderful telephonic link with us today?
If I refuse to answer, if I just filibuster, as we say politically in this country, you can't leave.
You've been so stubborn.
It was depressing. It became very depressing. It went from your departure has turned this from a magical show into a somber occasion.
No, there's always hope, Phil. There's always hope. Might pop in. You never know. I might go travel somewhere and you guys can phone me up again.
Reboot.
Yeah, foreign correspondent. Look, again.
Do you remember?
She's starting. Let's not kid ourselves. She's starting a rival show. That's what's going on.
Do you remember the classic?
Jessica Ward and Emma Tinson. We could tell you their superhero aliases, but then they'd have to stop saving the world.
Thankfully, Emma is still with us, albeit living somewhere outside London. But that's okay.
Yes.
So it goes. Anyway, carry on, Jessica.
The final question is, will we be hearing from you soon?
Well, I've got to focus on my studies and...
You're so cheeky.
Yes. Look, it was court ordered. My weekly appearances were ordered by the magistrate. So I don't have a choice in this.
But the cake was wonderful, Jessica.
Thank you.
When's Darren coming back? How long before Darren's there and I have to have watched the show, the movie?
16 days, I think you were saying. So.
Yeah, splendiferous nature in that movie. We thank Camo from Nashville, Anna Lewis, who couldn't actually make it, so we thank her in any case. So she'll be back next week from Jersey. Ashton Shepherd, Ed Fortune, Larry Nemechek, Peter Beale, and Phil Linus, and Tessa Snott, Hannah Brown, Jessica Ward, Natasha Armstrong, Darren Scales, and you, dear listener, for being part of the whole thing. That's it. We're pretty much out of here. To take us up to the news with 5 seconds of summer, can we say one final farewell to Jessica?
Farewell to Jessica.
The way that I've been loving you.
I've been talking to my friends. The way you take away my breath is something.